It's a vision then of a descent into chaos. The Duke does it here at the beginning of the play. He goes to Friar Thomas to get his disguise and then openly admits to the friar what he has done. We have strict statutes and most biting laws, the needful bits and curbs to headstrong weeds, which for this 14 years we have let slip, even like an o'ergrown lion in a cave that goes not out to prey. Now, as fond fathers, having bound up the threatening twigs of birch, only to stick it in their children's sight for terror, not to use, in time the rod becomes more mocked than feared. So our decrees, dead to infliction, to themselves are dead. And liberty plucks justice by the nose, the baby beats the nurse, and quite athwart goes all decorum. Who's telling us this? The man in charge. What's he admitting to? There are necessary laws. Without them, there will be chaos. For 14 years, I haven't enforced them. I haven't done anything. And it's just a mess now. Because nobody even respects them anymore. So what good are they? This is modern. This is modern. It's the Clinton foreign policy. It's the military leadership. It's the Pope giving in on altar girls. It's everywhere. Well, yeah, we have rules and laws, but we can't enforce them. We can't do that. And the obvious question is, why not? You're the Duke. He makes the excuse. The friar says it rested in your grace to unloose this tied up justice when you please. Good, sound Catholic sense. The friar gives good, sound advice. He does it politely. You have the power. And it in you more dreadful would have seemed than in Lord Angelo. You want to end this? Unleash those laws. And the people will be stunned. I do fear too dreadful. Since 'twas my fault to give the people scope, 'twould be my tyranny to strike and gall them for what I bid them do. For we bid this be done when evil deeds have their permissive pass and not the punishment. Therefore, indeed, my father, I have on Angelo imposed the office. Oh, no, I... Well, they won't like me. If I do this, they won't like me. Let him do it. Let them not like him. This is the starting place, and it is clearly a character who has failed to do his job, who now is trying to weasel out of it. The Duke begins the play as a compromised character, but I would also say a very human character. We would all love to be liked. He is also aware of what he's done. He's the one who admits to it. It's just he doesn't want to change it at this point. Now, as a result, we get the vision. And again, Shakespeare is clearly aware. Such actions, or in this case, inaction, has dire consequences. And what we see is a city in moral chaos. A city that is a moral shambles, in which vice has bubbled, as they say, till it or stews the pot. It's literally, the pot is running over with vice and corruption. We see it in a number of ways, but more importantly, we see the reaction. It is here, I think, that the play speaks to us in a very important way. And I want to look at Angelo and Isabella, whose conflict then becomes central as the play begins its movement. If the Duke himself has created this situation, recognizes the moral chaos around him, it has created a situation in which the good are as much in danger as anyone else. We hear early on praise for Angelo. The Duke says, there is a kind of character in my life that to the observer doth thy history fully unfold. Angelo is presented to us as a good man. The Duke trusts him. The Duke says he will do a good job as his substitute. The first words out of Angelo's mouth are, "Now, good my lord, let there be some more test made of my mettle before so noble and so great a figure it be stamped upon it." Angelo's first words. "Test me. I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I'm up to this." And the Duke brushes it off. Angelo has a degree of self-knowledge from the beginning. "I don't know," he says. "I'm uneasy." The next time we see him, the very next scene in which he appears, he is spouting a rigid law. "We must not make a scarecrow of the law, setting it up to fear the birds of prey, and let it keep one shape till custom make it their perch and not their terror." He's right. And yet, this man who just said, "I'm not sure, I don't know how I'll do, test me before you put me in this position," is now an absolutist. This is the way it is. He has arrested Claudio and condemned him to death under the law. He is now imposing those laws. But the first case that comes in before him are these nerds, elbow froth bumping. Now, he begins the scene with this grand proclamation and suddenly confronts a very real case. The way of the world is often sloppy and unclear. You can't even get out of these guys what happened. They can barely speak the language. Something was done to Elbow's wife. Elbow is accusing them. Pompey is trying to defend her. Froth is just a nincompoop. We don't know what he's doing. And, number one, Angelo loses patience. Two, Elbow is the constable. He is the one who is supposed to have been keeping order in his little borough. The man's incompetent. We have a vision of the problem at the top is going all the way down to the bottom. At the end of the scene, Aeschylus says to him, "How long have you been doing this?" He says, 7.5 years. They keep putting me into this position. "What? I'm elected to it, okay? They elect me sheriff." With the obvious reason, the man can't do anything. He's incompetent. And he says, "Well, even pay me a little something, too." And Aeschylus, wise man that he says, "Bring me a list of other men in your in your district who could do this job. I'm appointing somebody else." But finally, Angelo, instead of sorting out the case and deciding it on the merits, says the following. "This will last out a night in Russia when nights are longest there." Now, we sympathize. These are idiots. And it's impossible hearing them talk. "I'll take my leave and leave you to the hearing of the cause." What's he doing? Exactly what the Duke did. "I don't want to listen to this. This is messy. I want to make grand pronouncements about the law and justice. I don't want to hear these nasty cases." "Aeschylus, you do it." The Duke just said, "Angelo, you do it." And then says, "And leave you to the hearing of the cause, hoping you'll find good cause to whip them all." They do not all necessarily deserve whipping. The point of justice is to draw these fine distinctions. But we already have a sense in the man, again, of an absolutist. "I've assumed power, I'm in this position, I'm good." He's given a little speech when Aeschylus has said, "Don't kill Claudio, he comes of a good family, it's not that grave an error. 'Tis one thing to be tempted, Aeschylus," he says, "another thing to fall." Law, you know, puff, 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 pride, pride, pride. "I'm good, I'm..." And then we see, he's just as human as the Duke. "Bring me a good case. Bring me a, you know, don't bring me these jerks. I hope you whip them all." That's not justice. That's not justice. We have a man who is unsure of himself, therefore elevating himself, not doing his basic job, spouting these abstract visions of purity and goodness and justice. He's, pride goeth before a fall, and he's ready to fall. It's not surprising. It's not surprising. But please notice, it is indeed out of this corruption in which he dwells that he is assuming, if you would, a false goodness an inhuman goodness, an abstract goodness. It is a great danger. What he does not recognize is his humanity. The other characters even know it. Lucio says to Isabella at one point, his blood is very congealed snow, he says. Okay? Another point he says, you know, his very urine is ice. Their vision of this man is he doesn't have human passions in him at all. He is human. He has passions. He's going to discover them. Don't ever allow yourself to believe you are above the common lot of humanity. We are all in this together. God made us all in the same way. He made us for a reason. We are creatures of nature. You stand a bull next to the cow in the pasture, and certain things are going to happen because God designed it that way. But fortunately, God gave us reason so we can know this and find different fields to move to. But the bull that pretends I'm above it all is going to get in real trouble. We are human. Angelo is pretending to be above humanity. He is not, and he's going to find it out. It is a grave danger, especially in a time of corruption. Especially, I would say, in the modern world. Pray for virtue. Remain humble. Be on guard. You too are human. Okay? Lucio also says that the rumor was he's not made the way that the rest of us were made. He says about it. Well, the fact is he was, and he's going to prove it. We all were. We all were. And there's nothing wrong in that. There is something wrong in pretending we are more than human, or above the fray, or not touched with those things that are our common human lot. And if you don't have that observance in mind and an awareness of it, then there is a good chance that when you encounter an Isabella, there could be real trouble. And it happens. Now, we get that division in Angelo. I'm going to leap ahead to the soliloquy he gives after he first sees her. Something happens in him. He is aware of it. The man goes like that. He begins the scene in control, absolutely sure of himself, and by the end he's going, "Oh!" He's in anguish. It happens. Shakespeare knew it. It happens just that quickly. She leaves and says, "Save your honor." He says, "From thee, even from thy virtue." What's this? What's this? Is this her fault or mine? It's nobody's fault. He has no idea how to deal with this. Life has sprung up in him. It's something new. He didn't know it was there. The tempter or the tempted, who sins most? Ha, not she, nor doth she tempt, but it is I, that lying by the violet in the sun, do as the carrion does, not as the flower, corrupt with virtuous season. Get the image. It's a spring day, the sun is shining down, we have two objects out in a field. A violet, Isabella, that springs into life in beauty as the sun comes down on it, and carrion, dead meat. We know what the sun does to that. He is quite literally saying, I'm dead meat. I'm dead meat. Suddenly the sun is shining down on him and he stinks. This is nonsense. This is nonsense. What is he? He's a human being who has suddenly seen a beautiful woman and feels things that he doesn't understand. He is not dead meat. But notice the next image of himself. Can it be that modesty may more betray our sense than woman's lightness? Having waste ground enough, shall we desire to raise the sanctuary and pitch our evils there? Oh, fie, fie, fie. What dost thou, or what art thou, Angelo? Dost thou desire her foully for those things that make her good? Oh, let her brother live. Thieves for their robbery have authority when judges steal themselves. What, do I love her? That I desire to hear her speak again and feast upon her eyes? What is it I dream on? Oh, cunning enemy, that to catch a saint with saints doth bait the hook. What is he now? Now he's a saint. 5 lines ago he was dead meat, stinking in the sun. Now he's a saint. He is not a sinner. He does not know who he is. There is no self-knowledge here. Such a man should not be in a position of authority. This is a frightening vision. But Shakespeare gives us the sense of the torment this individual goes through when suddenly confronted with something he does not know. Most dangerous is that temptation that doth goad us on to sin in loving virtue. Never could the strumpet, with all her double vigor, art, and nature, once stir my temper, but this virtuous maid subdues me quite. Ever till now, when men were fond, I smiled and wondered how. And Shakespeare ends the soliloquy with that rhymed couplet to underline the point. At least he admits this. Up until this point, when men behaved foolishly, as men will do, I smiled and wondered how they could be so foolish. He has been removed, abstracted, distant, better than everyone else, not touched with those things like other men who behave foolishly. It is extremely sad what's happened to him. It is also, in some ways, a blessing. Because over the course of this play, he will regain his humanity. It will be a painful process. It will be rending for him. He will be exposed publicly, but it will be good for him. And at the end, he makes a good marriage to a good woman who loves him. We're not quite sure why. although she says, they say best men are molded out of faults, and for the most become much more the better for being a little bad. Which is often the case. She understands that. She is a wise woman. He's lucky to get her. But we also find out later, and we don't find out till much later, he indeed made the marriage contract with her. She is betrothed to him. They have exchanged that bond, that commitment, and then he deserted her. And she has done, in one sense, the right thing. She's lived in isolation. We again have that awful, awful sense of this world that Shakespeare is presenting is one where the most simple bonds can't even exist. And the characters are so disoriented and disordered that they're separated from each other. Now, let me move on to Isabella. Isabella has occasioned more debate than anything else in this play. And she is a magnificent creation. She's one of Shakespeare's great characters. But she is not simple. She is not easy to understand. She has that in her that is remarkable. And she is also a very real woman, a living, breathing human being. She is also, as the play begins, as is Angelo, a result of, if you will, the situation in the society in which she finds herself. Beginning of her first scene, she's in the nunnery, she's talking to Francisca. We come into the middle of the conversation and Isabella says, "And have you nuns no farther privileges?" And Francisca says, "Are not these large enough?" "Oh yes, truly, I speak not as desiring more, but rather wishing a more strict restraint upon the sisterhood, the votaress of St. Clair." "Oh no, I don't want more freedom. I want less." This is, again, an overreaction to a corrupt world. Just as Angelo has overreacted by becoming more than human, inhuman in his sense of his superiority, this poor young woman is fleeing that corrupt world and going to the convent for, I would say, perhaps the wrong reason. What is she seeking? Order, structure, restraint. It is understandable because she comes from a society that is in chaos. But it is not the sense of what can I learn here? What will my position here be? What are your rules? It's give me more order. Give me more rules. Bind me in more closely. We could say that perhaps she is taking refuge, which is understandable and human given the world that she has come out of. But it also suggests that there is something not necessarily right in her reason for being there, which I think becomes very important in understanding the ending of the play. very quickly, we have another character who does not understand himself. It's the Duke. I already talked about the scene with Friar Thomas where he admits what he's done, but the opening of that scene is instructive. We come into the middle of a conversation, and Friar Thomas has obviously said, you want to come here and pretend to be a friar for a while, right? Because is it a love thing you've gotten involved in? The Duke says, no, Holy Father, throw away that thought. Believe not that the dribbling dart of love can pierce a complete bosom. The dribbling dart of love can pierce a complete bosom? That doesn't say anything about love. It doesn't say anything about the bosom of the man. It tells us something about this man who does not understand himself, nor does he understand love. Oh, no, I'm above love. Oh, love? No. Love has nothing to do with me. I'm complete. This is a man who has much to learn. My point is this, we begin the play. Angelo doesn't know himself. Isabella doesn't know herself. The Duke doesn't know himself. They're in a society in chaos. The Duke is seeking to escape. Angelo doesn't want responsibility and escapes by being better than everybody else. Isabella seeks to escape by going to the convent and hiding, and hopefully they'll give her even more rules than usual. There is only one character at the beginning of the play who knows himself, Claudio. He's condemned to death. He is hauled through the streets of Vienna. Lucio sees him being dragged away and says, why, how now, Claudio? Whence comes this restraint? Why are you tied up? Where are you going? Whence comes this restraint? And Claudio says, from too much liberty, my Lucio. Liberty. Boom! Insight. Yeah, I'm going to prison. It's my own fault. I was too free. Now, this is not a man who sought to hide out anywhere from the world. It's a man who committed an action in the world and now has indeed been arrested for it and in public is admitting it from the beginning. Is he putting the blame on anyone else? Nope. From too much liberty, my Lucio, liberty, as surfeit is the father of much fast. So every scope, by the immoderate use, turns to restraint. That's a wonderful line. Our natures do pursue like rats that raven down their proper bane, a thirsty evil, and when we drink, we die. There's an image of human nature and a frightening one. We are like those rats, you put out the rat poison for them, and the piggy little rats go, and eat it all down, okay? And you say, look at that dumb animal, that's poison, I don't care, give me more, okay? This is wisdom. Claudio has done a wrong in the world and admits it. We get the counter scene when the Duke, in disguise, meets Julia. And he says to her, he speaks quite openly to her, very quickly. Love you the man that wronged you. Yes, as I love the woman that wronged him. So then it seems your most offenseful act was mutually committed. Mutually. Then was your sin of heavier kind than his? Ooh, that's a great line to toss into a modern classroom. It's a hand grenade. That's not Shakespeare the modernist. The man and woman sin together and the heavier burden lies on the woman. Whoa! They rise up and throw things at me when I say that. They throw their books on the ground, and then I explain it to them. And it's nothing more than good, sound Catholic theology. Boom! There it is. And she says, I do confess it and repent it, Father. This couple is healthy, and the miracle is they've remained healthy in the midst of this corruption. They've done a wrong. They admit the wrong. Claudio's going to go to his punishment. Now, Claudio has one lapse, and it's a serious lapse. Although there's another reason for that. We go into the prison. The point I am making is that in some ways, the sane, sensible characters in this world are the ones who are going to be punished. Who's going to be put to death? Claudio, did he do it wrong? Yes. Was it wrong under the law? Yes. Is he aware of it? Yes. Does he repent it? Yes. Kill him. And who's putting him to death? These people who really don't know themselves at all, don't understand the wrongs they're doing, don't know the world they live in, or in the case of the Duke, has created the situation, or an Angelo has made it worse. And at this point, we see that temptation scene, which is magnificent. In the course of it, Isabella, it's one of the great disquisitions on justice and mercy. I advise you to read it over. That scene and the great scene in Act 4, the trial scene of the Merchant of Venice, when Portia appears before the court. Shakespeare's great disquisitions on mercy and justice. They're very important. I'm not going to go through it right now. It is filled with wisdom. It deserves study in and of itself. Although she does say to him at one point, I do have to do this. Merciful heaven, thou rather with thy sharp and sulphurous bolt splits the unwedgeable and gnarled oak than the soft myrtle. She says, God understands, and she's referring to Angelo, okay? And he has become the unwedgeable and gnarled oak. I'm good. I'm better than you. Don't you tell me what to do. And it's a warning. She says, You are still under God's judgment, and boy, when he hits you, it's going to be powerful. As opposed to, as she says, the soft myrtle. God will send the wind, and the myrtle will bend and say, oh, yeah. So the gnarled oak, it's going to take that sulphurous thunderbolt. Kaboom! Oh, wow. See, you're a tree. forgot. Sorry. That's what happens to Angelo. It is a thunderbolt. Kaboom. My students, almost to the letter, this is the modern world. This is a class I prepare for. Say, why doesn't you just sleep with him? That's the modern world. What's the big deal? And then we have to get into mortal sin. And there. What? What? Her soul? What? They don't really see it as a problem. During the course of that discussion, I always say this. Yes, to engage in sexual activity out of marriage is a mortal sin, and it means you're damning your souls to hell. And there, now I've told you, which means on the day of judgment you can't say, I never knew, nobody ever told me. I just told you. Tough luck. I've had students never speak to me again. I had one student who stamped out of class, didn't utter another word, sat for the rest of the semester glaring at me, and did not speak to me again for the two following years she was at the academy. Which means, ooh, it took root. Woo! Woo! It's a shocker for them. They don't like to hear it. We go to the prison. The Duke goes to comfort Claudio and says, it's so wonderful. He says, so then you hope for pardon from Lord Angelo. The miserable will have no other medicine but only hope. I have hope to live and am prepared to die. Sound sense. Yes, I hope I may live, but I am prepared to die. The Duke responds, be absolute for death. Either life or death shall thereby be the sweeter, and launches into a speech. Reason thus with life, if I do lose thee, I do lose a thing that none but fools would keep, he says to a dying man. And goes through this incredible speech about how life is really just pretty rotten anyway. There is a grain of truth there. Is this comfort to a dying man? He finishes this long speech, his longest speech in the play, but again it tells us more about the Duke than about Claudio. Life, forget it. Just be, hope you die. And Claudio says, I humbly thank you. To sue to live, I find I seek to die, and seeking death, find life, let it come on. He says the right thing. He says the pious thing. Does he believe it? Who could at that moment? Isabella comes in, and we have that awful confrontation between brother and sister. The Duke, however, instead of leaving, says what? Hide me where I can watch this. Now, why does he want to watch? He's just talked to Claudio. Isabella comes in for a very obvious reason, I think. He got a look at Isabella, just as Angelo did. But with this difference, he does take an interest in her. He does take an interest in Claudio. But his interest is proper, and he suddenly realizes as he watches brother and sister go at it, she says, "You're going to die." He says, "I don't want to die. Do it anyway, will you? Please?" And she says, "You're awful! You're not my father's son!" It is not their finest moment on either side. There is plenty we can criticize on both sides, but I would say this, it's fully human. And when Claudio launches into that eye, but to die and go we know not where, to lie in cold obstruction and to rot, this warm sense of emotion to become a kneaded clod, whoa, we get the sense of the fear of death that is much stronger than the nice little platitudes the Duke has just been uttering. Death is a real thing to him, a powerful thing. The Duke sees this and finally enters the world he's supposed to be governing. Finally seeing a brother and sister go at each other, and he has to recognize who's responsible for this. He is. It's his doing. And the play shifts. Please notice, his interest in Isabella and Claudio becomes genuine now. He becomes a ruler watching out for his people. But it has taken the descent into the prison, the condemnation to death of a young man who has done something that is certainly in some ways much less severe than what those pimps and bawds and whores are doing all around the rest of the city. And now this terrible, terrible moment as brother and sister, as quite literally this family is ripped apart, and it's his fault. He enters the play, he begins finally to do something. And we watch the movement of the play toward its conclusion. Still in darkness, still veiled, still undercover, but now the Duke moves through the play as a healing force, using authority. Managing, moving, concerned, loving, what he should have been all along. The play can now move toward a comic ending. Let me say something else, however. There is a little line he gives in Act 4. He's talking to the provost. The day is dawning when all will be resolved, and he says to the provost, "Look, the unfolding star calls up the shepherd." He means, day is dawning, I gotta get about my business. He refers to himself as a shepherd. He is to watch out for his people. He admits it. But there is also clearly in that reference, look, the unfolding star calls up the shepherd, a remembrance of that other star that called up other shepherds. The play was first performed December 26, 1604. It was written and first performed for Christmas entertainment before James I. It is, curiously, in one sense, a Christmas play. It is about, if you will, a world of corruption and horror and eye for an eye justice that finally has someone of authority to come into it, take the responsibility, and by showing mercy, as well as reinstating the law, move the world to a happy ending. There are some people who read the whole play allegorically. I don't do that, I think it's too extreme, but I would say that obviously there is a vision here of that benevolent ruler who goes among his people and finally seeing the situation in which they find themselves, works out a happy ending for them. And indeed, that is recalled early on in the play when Isabella is first speaking to Angelo and says, "Alas, alas, why all the souls that were forfeit once. And he that might the vantage best have took found out the remedy. We were all under that death sentence. And that man who quite rightly pronounced the death sentence on us found out the remedy, brought about the healing, redeemed us." That reminder is there early in the play, and the play, as a result, indeed, can have a happy ending. How would you be if he, which is the top of judgment, should but judge you as you are? Oh, think on that, and mercy then will breathe within your lips like man new made. And the coming of mercy into the world, indeed, that baptism, the possibility of that baptism, meant that man could be new made. And the Duke, in finally doing what he needs to do, the Duke as the authority figure, the Duke as the benevolent ruler, but now a stern ruler as well, becomes, if you will, that representative of God within the city of Vienna and restores order. And the play suggests, and it is hopeful, things get bad, but there can still be order. This is a comedy, and a comedy reassures us at the end. There can be regeneration, there can be renewal, there can be that new hope. The final turning point, however, is not just the Duke, because the Duke has one other test that he must put Isabella through. Or let me put it this way, the possibility of that new world, of that restored city, depends on the assent of the woman. And he poses what seems an impossible situation for her. He has led her to believe that her brother is dead. He has condemned Angelo. Mariana kneels down and prays to the Duke for Angelo and says, "Finally, Isabel, sweet Isabel, do yet but kneel by me. Hold up your hands, say nothing, I'll say all. They say best men are molded out of faults, and for the most become much more the better for being a little bad. So may my husband. Oh, Isabel, will you not lend a knee?" The Duke says he dies for Claudio's death, as he has said earlier, and Angelo for Claudio, death for death. Haste still pays haste, and leisure answers leisure. Like doth quit like, and measure still for measure. It's stern. It's stern. It's Old Testament. It's hard justice. It's what she spoke against earlier in the play. And now the question is, can she convert her own heart in the manner that she lectured Angelo to do earlier? Or, if I may, another verse from Matthew. "But I say unto you, ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hurt you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you," which is what Angelo has done to Isabella. And the charge that the Duke now puts before her is, eye for an eye. "Against all sense do you importune her. Should she kneel down in mercy of this fact, her brother's ghost his paved bed would break and take her hence in horror. If she kneels down to beg for his life, her brother will come back from the dead and take her off in horror." Well, he got half of it right. If she kneels and begs for mercy, then there is a new order. Then the world is new made. If she assents to this, against common sense and the hard rule of justice, then there is the possibility for all men to be new made. She kneels. It's one of the great dramatic moments ever, as all eyes are Isabella. The whole future quite literally hinges on her. as it did once before on the answer of another woman who had an impossible proposal put before her and again assented. Most bounteous sir, look if it please you on this man condemned, as if my brother lived. I partly think a due sincerity governed his deeds till he did look on me. Since it is so, let him not die. My brother had but justice in that he did the thing for which he died. For Angelo, his act did not o'ertake his bad intent, and must be buried but as an intent that perished by the way. Thoughts are no subjects, intents but merely thoughts. And she asks for mercy for the man who wronged her, and she believes killed her brother. And, boom, happy ending. Her brother is restored. Angelo is married to Mariana. Lucio is forgiven, but has to marry the woman that he got with child. The city explodes in joy. It is a vision of a whole and of course, the media is there to report it. I find it a great comfort that in the midst of Shakespeare's dark, tragic period, as he was writing Hamlet and Othello and Lear and Macbeth, and had a clear sense of the depths to which human nature could descend, he could write this play that also takes a grim, tough view of humanity, makes no excuses for it, but still has to admit that possibility that man can be new made, that mercy can triumph over justice, that order can be restored. But only, I would say, in that context that he was raised in, that he knew very well, from the family that raised him to those first plays he saw, and that is the Catholic world. We know one thing. It's in a letter written by a Protestant minister who lived in Stratford at the time of Shakespeare's death. He was writing to a friend and said with disgust, "Master Shakespeare died a papist." Not surprising, since I am firmly convinced he spent his life working out those Catholic ideas in his plays, and certainly would have gone to his rest honoring his maker, receiving the last rites of the church that he had defended for his career. Thank you very much.